Oxide Radio, Oxford University's only student-run radio station.
Hello and welcome to Oxford Today. This is Oxide Radio's interview series with your station manager, Theo Davis-Lewis. Now, over the last few weeks and months, as I tell you at the start of every episode, we've been speaking to some of the most prestigious and important people around Oxford. But today we have Kevin Rudd in the studio, not only an important figure here in the UK now, after moving over here to do his PhD at Oxford. He is a former Australian Prime Minister from 2007 to 2010 and again in 2013. I'm delighted to have Mr. Rudd in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Theo, on this bright, sunny Oxford afternoon.
Well, you know, it's a bit disappointing, but hopefully here at Oxide, we can sort of brighten your day up. And how are you finding everything to begin with in Oxford? You've moved here, as I said, to do a PhD on sort of Chinese politics, Xi Jinping, and everything like that. How's it finding?
Well, the Oxford China Centre, which is where I live and have my being, is a good centre for the study of modern China by international standards. Mm. And so there is a good group of China scholars there. I'm working under Rana Mitter, who's the head of the centre, and these are seriously bright folks. So in terms of the work I want to do and the book I ultimately want to write, which is on Xi Jinping's worldview, it's a good place to be. So I'll be in and out of Oxford over the next 2 to 3 years, hopefully applying just a modicum of academic discipline to train or at least subdue some of the innate prejudices I've already developed on this subject.
And looking at specifically your PhD to begin with then, you've always said that you've been interested in China from a young age and you speak fluent Mandarin. So what was the turning point for you actually wanting to actually study the worldview of the one, arguably the most powerful man in the world now?
I think it's probably the great question of our age, which over the last 200 years, by and large, the Anglosphere has dominated global politics and global economics, and frankly, the global academy as well. That's in a process of change, as the Chinese would describe it, in a process of radical transition and adjustment. And this is driven largely by the rise of China's economic power. So that now, by purchasing parity pricing terms, we have China as the largest economy in the world already. And within a decade, against the other classical measure, market exchange rates, China are likely to pass the United States as well. So to put into context, by the time we get to the next decade, it'll be the first time since George III was on the throne that you'll have a non-English-speaking, non-Western, non-democratic country being the largest economy in the world. And if anyone thinks that everything's just going to stay the way it was, then they're smoking something.
And if you look at the specific issues then as well,
and not necessarily tobacco.
But if you look at sort of the specific issues then, you're looking at his worldview, you've sort of talked strongly about climate change. Even when you were Prime Minister in Australia, you sort of advocated sort of making sure that we can alleviate the problems of climate change. You know, famously saying back in 2009, those Chinese fuckers are trying to rat fuck us.
Well, that is an inaccurate paraphrase of a off-the-record briefing I provided to the Australian media.
Yeah.
The essential argument I was seeking to convey, however, using all the rich diversity of the Australian lexicon, was that China at that stage in 2009 at the Copenhagen conference were obstructionist. But they weren't alone in that. So was India. And in fact, so were the BRICS countries by and large. And they effectively denied a global consensus, finally and formally, on what we negotiated as the Copenhagen Accord. The result of that conference was that we had amongst the negotiators within the G20 group a virtual agreement among those delegations. But the Chinese and others denied consensus on the conference floor. Mm. Of course, 12 months later, China had already begun to change its tune, and that was consistent with changes in China's domestic policy orientation on climate change as well, driven by its own domestic concerns. So the 12 months later, by the time we got to the next conference of the parties, which I think was in Cancun in Mexico, China did not deny consensus. So it was a difficult, shall I say, hard time at Copenhagen, which brought together two radically different worldviews, for which I make no apology.
And if we look, you know, aside from China now, and look at what's happened recently in Australia, back home, because I think a lot of people, well, they've heard your view already, but what's happening with same-sex marriage, people have been reacting positively around the world to the recent sort of referendum, not a binding referendum, on sort of voting for, Australians voting for same-sex marriage or agreeing with the policy of same-sex marriage. You know, how did you sort of feel about that? Because obviously you're sort of famously known as the Prime Minister who came out in support of same-sex marriage. You've talked articulately about how your godson, for example, was attacked, you know, for standing up for somebody.
Well, that's true. I mean, when I was in office, in 2007, when I was first elected, I was elected on a platform of not changing the Marriage Act. My plans for the 2010 election were to then go to the people and to say, if I'm returned as Prime Minister, then we will put this question to the Parliament immediately and let the members of Parliament decide. Unfortunately, we had an internal coup within the Labour Party, and I was replaced for a while by Julia Gillard as Prime Minister. Julia Gillard had made an arrangement with the conservative groupings within the Labour Party not to change the law, nor to present a bill to Parliament. However, when I returned to the leadership in 2013 of the Labour Party and as Prime Minister, I went to that election saying to the Australian people that if the government was returned, we would then put it before Parliament. Of course, Tony Abbott, a conservative, unlike myself, an Oxford graduate, led the Conservative charge against what I was proposing to do. And there it's languished ever since, until, of course, this most recent, shall I say, consultative postal vote across the Australian people, which came out more than 60% in favour.
And if you look then at, you talk about Tony Abbott and the Conservatives and their response to this, is there a danger that there is a right wing, not only in Australia but perhaps other parts of the world, that are imposing their view, which could actually stop this being passed in Parliament?
Well, it's always a risk that the Conservatives will, within the current governing Conservative Party, the far right, will seek to subvert what the voice of the Australian people has so clearly expressed it wants to be, the change in the law. However, they'll be very brave to do so. My bet on balance is that this law will get through. Hopefully by the early new year, the laws of the Commonwealth of Australia will be brought into line with most of the rest of the collective West.
And you've talked about as well looking at getting Christians involved in politics. And I had the Bishop of Oxford in here recently, and he was talking how he found it kind of quite challenging to accept same-sex marriage and sort of legislating that into sort of law in the Church of England. Is it difficult to find that balance between sort of religion and politics and moral issues then?
Well, I've made no bones about the fact that I'm a practicing God botherer myself. I describe myself as a Christian of no fixed denominational abode, and grew up as a Roman Catholic, married an Anglican, and that's about the end of it. And so my own view is that the question of marriage, however, is ultimately a question for the state, and therefore it is for reasonable women and men elected to our national parliaments to make a determination as they seek to reflect their communities as well as, of course, reflect their own consciences. So for me, whereas I would always seek to protect the church from being able to have its own definition of marriage as it sees to be theologically appropriate, that is quite a separate matter from whether the state should allow marriage equality and same-sex marriage. So I am perfectly comfortable with holding those two positions. I don't know what the Bishop of Oxford's position is on this, but you know, many Christians have wrestled this with some time. In the 2013 election campaign in Australia, I was famously confronted by some reverend from somewhere in a huge public debate with about 1,000 people present, where I did challenge him on the basis of his scriptural authorities that if we were to take everything as literally etched in stone from the Old Testament and New Testament, then we'd still be stoning prostitutes. We would, of course, be defending slavery, and we should have therefore fought with the Confederacy, and that women, of course, should still be subject to their husband's authority, even if they are being smashed to pieces through acts of domestic violence. I didn't think that was entirely wise, nor did I think it was necessarily the right interpretation of the contemporary Christian tradition.
And some of the other issues you've been very vocal about include the press in Australia, and you've talked about you've actually called for a royal commission into how the Murdoch press is actually sort of handling itself in Australia. Tell us more about, for the people that may not know here in Oxford, your objections perhaps to how they sort of Murdoch and sort of the power and the control and the influence they have in Australia.
Well, as someone who has spent the last 20 years of his life in one form of direct political involvement or another, culminating in being the Prime Minister of the country, you get to know the beast fairly well, by which I mean the Murdoch press. And so in Australia, we've usually found ourselves as the Australian Labor Party in constant contest with a conservative coalition made up of the formal Conservative Party plus the Murdoch Party. And the Murdoch Party have basically acted as a corporate beast masquerading as a news operation. And the corporate beast has sought to dominate the media industry in Australia. It already owns 70% of the Australian print media. But if you go beyond Australia, you look here at its control of the Times, the Sunday Times, the Sun, and you look at this extraordinary proposal currently before the British government and Parliament that they should be allowed to purchase fully the Sky Television Network. And in the United States, where they have Fox and Fox News, as well as owning the Wall Street Journal at one end and the New York Post at the other, and a whole bunch of outlets in between, the extraordinary power which this individual wields is of itself a concern. Secondly, when we look at Trump's America, Trump's America would not be possible if it was not for the echo chamber of Fox News, made possible by Rupert Murdoch. And thirdly, in this country, the United Kingdom, I doubt very much whether Brexit, the vote, would have happened in the way in which it did, had it not attracted the full support of, for example, the Sun at one end, and of course the Times at the other.
And you talk about these different things, but is there a solution to it then? Is there a solution to actually making sure that there isn't so much power in somebody's hands?
Well, the solution lies obviously in maximising media diversity. And my humble submission in this country is that if you wish to maximise media diversity, then allowing the already significant position of the Murdoch press in print to then translate itself into full control over one of your principal television networks, I think that would be a bridge radically too far. This is not a question of left, centre-right, or conservative versus Labour. It's a question of the future of the health of the democratic project. People say we now are entered into post-truth politics. Well, that's not just the fault of the Russians. It's not just the fault of social media with views uncontested. It's also the fault of an entrenched right-wing media, which has constantly said that black is white and white is black through a range of treatments of core news debates of the day. My own experience, for example, being depicted on the front page of the Australian newspapers wearing Nazi uniforms, a Nazi uniform because I dared to disagree with Lord Rupert Murdoch.
And if you look specifically again in the UK, I was talking to Nick Robinson, the former political editor of the BBC, about this. We still technically do have a sort of Fox News in our country in the form of RT. And we've now got the former First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, doing his own show on there. You know, what's your view on stations like that actually having an influence as well, funded by the Kremlin, famously, and, you know, blatantly pro-Kremlin? Is that another sort of side of the spectrum you have to look at, not just the right-wing press?
Well, my concern, it depends on one's definition of right and left here. My simple proposition is that you need to maximise media diversity. Secondly, the thing about RT, or for example its Chinese equivalent, the CCTV, is that nobody bloody watches it. So its actual net impact as a formal news organisation in this country, and frankly in mine in the United States, is fairly limited. The core question, however, is simply one of the factual nature of the material which is put forward to the British public, the Australian public, or the American public, and the separation constantly of fact from opinion rather than convergence of the above. As another practical measure beyond diversity itself, the idea and the proposal of cross-newspaper fact-checking groups which then independently assess the factual validity of a given assertion in any of the newspapers or in any of the contributors to the public debate, be it from RT or through to social media platforms or to the so-called centre-left media in this country, I think that's to be encouraged. It's the ultimate fusing of fact with opinion, which we see run every day, 24 hours a day, on Fox News in the United States, and I live in New York, which frankly pollutes the polity. My broader proposition is the Murdoch media empire represents, for the collective West, a deep cancer on our democracy.
But do you think that anything will change? Do you think that there will be some sort of change across the world, but also in the UK?
Well, the British Parliament and the British government have the right of saying yes or no to the buyout of Sky by News Corporation. Let me give you one further example. I think it's important given the debate in the United Kingdom. First and foremost, News Corporation is a corporation with a deep corporate interest, which is to make money. Secondly, it also happens to be ideologically conservative, and these things are not mutually exclusive. They tend to be reinforcing. But in Australia, for example, I, as Prime Minister, sought to lay out a national broadband network right across Australia. Cost $43 billion Australian dollars, fibre optic to the premises, the home, the business, the school, the factory, or the hospital, with 100 megabits plus per second. Bandwidth, band speed, world standard, to make sure a country as remote geographically as Australia was linked with the new emerging digital economy at every level. Excuse me. Murdoch became very unhappy with that for the simple reason it was fibre optic to the premises, which meant it would therefore present a direct competitive challenge to the monopoly he had in Australia through the Fox Entertainment Network, which had a cable monopoly or a virtual cable monopoly within Australia. In other words, if we did what we did for national economic reasons, his immediate concern was that global entertainment providers like Netflix would have an ability to therefore immediately broadcast their services through a fibre optic to the premises or fibre optic to the home network. And so as a consequence, Murdoch declared a jihad on our government's policy and then on our government. And furthermore, when the Conservative coalition faced us at the 2013 election, mysteriously their policy on the national broadband network was not only to destroy ours, but to create one as a replacement, which provided no such threat to News Corporation's interests. Even when they launched the policy, where did they do it? At the News Corporation Fox Entertainment studios in Sydney. So much was the coalition of interests. So on big stuff like that, when you have, I think, the direct national infrastructure project designed next infrastructure platform for Australia's transition to the global digital economy, it was targeted and destroyed amidships and torpedoed by the Murdoch media enterprise because it was a direct corporate threat to their interests.
So it sounds like as if even in Australia, it was perhaps even a worse situation than we have in the UK, you'd see maybe. Do you think that the position of the Murdochs in Australia is even more powerful than in the UK?
Well, remember, it started there. And so therefore the acquisition of mastheads over the years has continued apace. And so when in each Australian major city, you have the National Daily, which is the Australian newspaper fully owned by Murdoch. Its nearest equivalent in this country, I presume, would be the Times. Secondly, in every state capital except Perth, the daily tabloid newspaper being a Murdoch masthead, the Brisbane Courier-Mail, the Sydney Daily Telegraph, the Melbourne Herald Sun, the Hobart Mercury, the Adelaide Advertiser, and the Northern Territory News are all Murdoch papers. In fact, during the campaign of 2013, each daily tabloid front page was, with rare exceptions, all written by the Murdoch team in Sydney, and then propagated nationwide to a total daily readership of about, you know, as I said, 3/4 of the Australian voting public. It has an effect.
Mm. And these political convictions that you have and different issues in society, they, as you say, probably come out in your recent memoirs that you've released, which you're launching, well, you're sort of launching tonight with Gordon Brown in the Oxford Union. And just reading over sort of, you know, what you said and sort of your own history, and you talked about how you, maybe sort of your upbringing maybe sort of formed you as a person, because obviously you had quite a difficult upbringing. You know, your father died when you were, you know, quite young. Did your childhood actually influence, you know, how you looked at different things and put, you know, your position in society in perspective?
Well, the bottom line, Theo, is we're all shaped by our experiences. You're shaped by how you were brought up and how, where you grew up, and your parents, your siblings, your the schools you went to, whatever they happen to have been. And we're all like that. I mean, human beings are like that the world over. In my case, in terms of difficulties in childhood, they are by no means unique in Australia, and certainly not unique here in the United Kingdom. But I think having grown up in a conservative rural area of Australia, and I'm not sure what the British equivalent of it would be, probably the backwaters of Yorkshire, I suppose, which last time I looked at Yorkshire was not a hugely Labour voting part of the world, at least rural Yorkshire. Then I think what affected me radically as a young child was when we were share farmers, we didn't own land, my father was killed in an accident, and suddenly we had nothing. And so going through the whole experience of being effectively without a place to call home for several years, at a very elemental level instilled in you a sense of justice and injustice. And that was at a time when I knew nothing about politics and never heard of the Labour Party. In fact, none of my family had ever had anything to do with the left of politics in Australia.
And is that perhaps why then, you know, talking about how you sort of essentially had no home to call, you know, somewhere to call home, is that why you sort of do have this sort of internationalist outlook and sort of try and welcome people? You criticised Malcolm Turnbull, for example, for not, you know, welcoming refugees and things like that in Australia. Is that sort of maybe linked with your own experiences maybe?
Well, I mean, running a national government, it's a difficult business. And certainly on the question of asylum seekers policy, it's difficult as well. In Australia, I was criticised for being both too lax in our approach to asylum seekers and then too tough in our approach to asylum seekers. It's a global challenge. But my view always has been that when you're dealing with the poorest of the poor, then our responsibility as governments around the world is to preference the poor because no one else is preferencing them. And therefore, when in the case of Turnbull's government, you had this extraordinarily punitive policy of holding people in offshore detention centres for more than 4 years, their status as refugees having already been determined, that goes way beyond that which was, shall I say, justifiable under international law. We had an agreement ourselves as a government that we would allow 12 months for such cases to be processed, but after that it was simply beyond the pale that he would sustain a policy of keeping people almost in permanent detention.
And you haven't just looked at these issues in Australia. You've also looked at some things that have been happening in Myanmar, for example, and the difficult position that you see Aung San Suu Kyi being in. And obviously, I can sort of perhaps tentatively say that we're both members of St. Hugh's College here in Oxford. There's been a lot of controversy in the JCR, the sort of junior common room in St. Hugh's, about our association with Aung San Suu Kyi, because there's a strong feeling in the student body that she isn't doing enough. And obviously, there's been international criticism of her. Do you think that this issue with the Rohingya will be solved anytime soon, and she will perhaps get back the respect that she used to have on the international stage?
The politics of Myanmar domestically are worthy of some reflection, and then we should begin to reach conclusions about Aung San Suu Kyi's level of culpability. The bottom line is, and having had a fair bit to do with this when I was both Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, achieving this transition from a military dictatorship to where we are at present took more than half a century. 16 years of incarceration as far as Aung San Suu Kyi was concerned, and a political compromise between herself and the military worked out in 2012, really, that whereas She would control the civilian arms of the government. The military arms of the government, including the internal police functions, would exclusively be the power of the Burmese military. And that has been the division of labour ever since she was sworn in as senior minister within the government and effectively its head of state. So the truth is this, and it's very hard, is that when Aung San Suu Kyi says to the Burmese military, you should implement the plan which has been agreed to and recommended by the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on the proper and humanitarian handling of the Rohingya, their humane repatriation from where they've now been sent into exile into Bangladesh, and for there to be a long-term process of reconciliation and economic livelihood and opportunity for this oppressed minority, Muslim minority. When Kofi Annan came up with that plan only several months ago, and she, after reviewing it, came out in full support of the implementation of that plan, the military the next day began this campaign in the Rakhine state to physically remove the Rohingya from that state and push them across the border. It was the Burmese military saying to Aung San Suu Kyi, listen, senior lady, you might be this country's notional head of state, but we actually call the shots when it comes to domestic security. And they acted in complete defiance of her. And they were engaged in what can only be described as appalling treatment of the Rohingya minority in the months since then, in defiance of the statement that she had made. Her private communications, as I understand them, with the Burmese military are direct, sharp, and difficult, which is, for God's sake, you have a responsibility to implement the international plan which has been agreed upon. Of course, the military's interests are serviced by two things. One, by painting her domestically as being supportive of the Rohingya majority because of her support for the Rohingya minority, because of her support for the Kofi Annan plan. Given the racist attitudes towards the Muslim minority across Burma, across Myanmar, she's therefore weakened domestically, politically, by the Burmese military. At the same time, the Burmese military and the Myanmar military are able in the court of international opinion to maintain their own low profile and blame Aung San Suu Kyi for the actual program of what appears to be a form of ethnic cleansing in the Rakhine state as well. Net result, weakened at home, weakened abroad, and then paving the way eventually for a return to military rule, Aung San Suu Kyi's position having been fundamentally undermined on the way through. So the reason I say we should reflect on the nature of internal domestic politics within Myanmar is that that's the daily reality she lives with. Should she have handled it better? I believe she should have. But understand that she represents a thin civilian government sitting on the top of a military and security apparatus which for a half century, including since the change in government, have done their own thing and intend to continue to do their own thing. So I think the international community would be well placed, including here at Oxford, to begin a campaign of, frankly, bans on the Burmese military from travelling abroad, bans on the export of armaments to the Burmese military, bans on common training exercises with the Burmese military, because they're the ones running amok here.
Do you think that she can stay in power then, just because you talk about how they're undermining her at home and abroad, really?
I think it's a very near thing. It's a very near-run thing. It's a close-run thing. And I think it would behove the international community to reflect on what would happen if she was removed next week, if they took actions to threaten her life, if they took actions to destroy her physically and politically. What will we then say? I mean, I think we need to understand the darkness within Burmese deep military politics before we point the universal finger of blame at her personally. As I said, I think she could have played this better, but it is easy for us on the outside to say you should have played this better when it could have been followed the day after by a military coup and her physical removal from office as well. This is still a work in progress. The treatment of the Rohingya minority is appalling. It is getting worse by the day. And there is an urgent need, I believe, for the United Nations through the Security Council to take action in a manner which is not simply focused on Aung San Suu Kyi, but focused on those who are actually calling the shots and, frankly, firing the shots in the Rakhine State, namely the Burmese military.
And you mentioned earlier that we're living in sort of a post-truth politics, and a lot has happened since you and Gordon Brown were in power in your respective countries. How have you seen politics change across the world? And we've seen so many different international events happen, even recently now, of course, in Myanmar. What's the sort of state of international affairs that you see? Because you've had experience in foreign affairs as a leader of a country, involved with the G20, the Commonwealth. How has it changed?
Perhaps the best way of answering that is to step back a little and say, what are the greatest global challenges we are facing, and do we any longer have the tools for dealing with them? That's probably the best way I could put it. One we've spoken about already, which is the rise and rise of China, which is one of the reasons why I'm here to think and reflect and hopefully write something intelligent on this. Can this occur peacefully in terms of the relationship between the rising power China and the established superpower the United States? I don't know. That's one of the reasons why I want to think that through. But the implications globally for how that turns out, and certainly regionally, are profound. Secondly, the question of the continued fragility of the global economy. Financial systems, which I fear, are beginning to lose sight of the lessons we learnt collectively in the crisis of 2008, for which I still carry large quantities of scar tissue, and I'm sure Gordon and other political leaders from the time do as well. And I look at the United States, where they're thinking of taking away some of the regulatory disciplines imposed after the crisis, and I wonder what, therefore, that will lead to if we have further asset inflation around the world and a reduction parallel to that of effective regulatory controls over significant individual financial players. The parallel economic challenge, as you know, is delivered by the revolution in artificial intelligence, and what effect that will have in terms of global labor substitution and the future employability of people. Third one's climate. It speaks for itself, where despite Paris, if it's fully implemented, represents a third of the actions necessary to keep global temperature rises between 1.5 and 2 degrees by the end of the century. But the fourth one, which worries me, is actually the state of our democratic processes and the state of, and the ability, therefore, the capacity, therefore, for us in the collective West to marshal the resources of these modern democratic nation states acting together to deal with one, two, and three above. And when I see democracies turning in on themselves, like here in the United Kingdom, and in terms of the decision to remove itself from Europe through the Brexit referendum, if I look at what's happened in the German elections and the collapse, for example, of coalition negotiations yesterday because of the arrival of Alternative for Deutschland, and I look in Australia, where politics now focuses increasingly inwards, and the United States, which speaks for itself, I see a collective West and the health of its democratic processes becoming wobblier and wobblier and wobblier. And so the revitalization of our democratic energies through open and free societies and open and free medias, which collectively themselves police their own truth standards, their own fact standards, etc., as part of the deep surgery we need to engage in if we're to deal with the great global challenges, which, my friend Theo, your generation will face the consequences of.
That's a very pleasant thought. And to end then, just on a happier note, because as some of you might know, my producer Mark is actually Australian.
We all have our problems.
Yeah. And, he does, as I said, he does keep me together. But he wanted to ask me, I asked you a question.
I didn't do it. No. That's usually my answer to any such question.
Well, actually, it's not whether you did it or whether you're going to do it, because he wanted to talk to you about the former prime ministers that we've had here in Australia, because Malcolm Turnbull, as you said, was educated at Oxford. Tony Abbott was as well. The most famous attendee was probably Bob Hawke, as you will know, perhaps, set the Guinness World Record for sculling 2.5 pints of beer in 11 seconds at Turf Tavern. So, Mark is put here, honestly, do you have any plans to beat him?
Well, I've gone into a training course here at Oxford because I'm not historically a big beer drinker. I don't mind a cold beer on a hot day. But you don't have many bloody hot days here. That's the problem.
There's a challenge.
There's a challenge.
You can't crack one open with the boys or anything like that.
No. Well, it's when we take the tops off bottles in Australia, we use our teeth. We don't use the... It's a little bit a feat, I think, just to use your hands. So
have you got yourself round Oxford, though? Have you sort of been to these?
I've been where Bob achieved his Guinness fame. He's well known in Australia for this as well. In fact, at every Sydney Test cricket test match, which is called the New Year's Day Test, you'll see Bob on camera. He's now in his late 80s. Always sculling a very tall glass of beer for the crowd. And so he's now become, I think, iconic in terms of his ability to do that. When they look at me, I think they see me more as the nerd from Central Casting. So could I possibly, through an appropriate training course, begin to emulate the great one? I'm not sure.
Kevin Rudd, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Oxide Radio, online and on demand. Listen back to all your favorite shows on oxideradio.live.